This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello everybody and welcome to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas and to this session of Coerced Treatment. Thank you for coming to this session today for what really is the tail end of the Festival of Ideas program. We appreciate your efforts on coming along at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon with the beautiful sunshine outside. We hope that you will enjoy this session. My name's Jane Anderson and I'm the MC today. Now, just a few matters of housekeeping first. Could mobile phones please be switched to silent? Also, just to let those of you who Twitter, to let you know there is an active Twitter following as part of the Festival of Ideas, and you're welcome to share your thoughts at Ideas Adelaide. And it's also important to provide that information if you want and are able to do so for those who can't make today's session. The Twitter hashtag is AFOI. Now, I'm very excited to be part of this discussion today. By way of background, I'm a lawyer, and in my former career, I used to prosecute people for criminal offences. More recently, I'm a deputy president of the Guardianship Board of South Australia. Now, much of the work I do at the Guardianship Board involves making decisions about whether to require people to undergo treatment for a mental illness, and often against their will. So I'm required to consider and apply what we call the least restrictive approach. What interests me about today's session is that we will be confronting the very real challenges and complexities surrounding the notion of coerced treatment. We know that drug-addicted offenders very often continue to commit crimes even after punishment. This raises a number of questions. Does this mean that imprisonment is not a sufficient deterrent? Instead, should we be looking at treatment for offenders rather than imprisonment? But how effective are forms of treatment? Will treatment actually reduce or prevent further offending? And should we as community and as legislators allow criminal courts to legally coerce addicted people to undergo treatments that involve the implantation of drugs or the use of vaccines to block the effect of addicted drugs? If it's your son or daughter or your brother and sister or sister who is addicted and has committed a crime, or if you are the homeowner who has been the victim of a home invasion which has been connected with drug addiction, you may well see these issues very differently. Do you think the addicted person should have treatment in jail, or should they be allowed to live in the community? Should they be allowed to have a say in the type of treatment they receive? Now, Wayne Hall is our speaker today. Wayne is a National Health and Medical Research Council Fellow in Neuroethics at the University of Queensland Centre for Clinical Research. Formerly, he was Professor of Public Health Policy in the School of Population Health, Director of the Office of Policy and Ethics at the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland, and Director of the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. He has advised the World Health Organisation on the health effects of cannabis use, the effectiveness of drug substitution treatment, scientific quality of the Swiss heroin trials, contribution of illicit drug use to the global burden of disease and ethical implications of genetic and neuroscience research on addiction. And he has been identified by the Institute for Scientific Information as one of the world's most highly cited social scientists in the past 20 years. Needless to say, we as participants in the Adelaide Festival of Ideas are very fortunate to have a world-renowned and leading authority sharing his work with us. Now, what Wayne is about to talk about is confronting. Indeed, the Festival of Ideas is about planning for uncertainty and seeking to challenge beliefs. What comes out of today's talk may make us feel uncomfortable and make us question whether it's right or wrong. Now, with this in mind, after Wayne's talk, we are going to devote some time to discuss the very real issues this topic raises. And I certainly encourage you all to ask questions and to seek those answers. And with that, I have great pleasure in introducing you to Wayne Hall.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for that introduction. And I also reiterate Jane's thanks for being here on such a beautiful Sunday afternoon when you could be outside in the sunshine. What I'm aiming to do today is to give you enough background on the idea of a drug vaccine and drug implants. And I'll be talking about two drugs, a vaccine against cocaine and an implantable antagonist, meaning a drug that blocks the effects of heroin. And I'll explain why those two drugs are the focus of my talk today. But I'm happy in the discussion afterwards to discuss the feasibility of this sort of approach being extended to a variety of other drugs that people do become dependent upon. So I'm going to talk a bit about the science underlying this particular approach, what the evidence is about, and then I want to look at ethical issues surrounding their potential use to treat addiction in the first place in willing subjects, that is people who come forward seeking treatment and help for their addiction, as it were, of their own free will, and the more contentious possibility of people who might be legally coerced into undergoing addiction treatment, as Jane has just indicated, people either offered treatment as an alternative to imprisonment if they've been convicted of an offence committed to fund their drug use, for example, or the more contentious and most restrictive form of treatment where people are not offered a choice but are compelled to undergo addiction treatment. I'll say something briefly at the end about the potential use of these approaches, particularly vaccines, to prevent addiction, because you can't mention the concept of a drug vaccine without somebody wanting to know, where can I get some for my kid? So the sorts of the approach that I'll be taking is to attempt to answer these sorts of questions that I've sort of lumped together under the rubric of policy analysis. I'll spend a bit of time addressing the first one. I think this is an important question, that is, can we? Are these sorts of approaches feasible, practicable, affordable, and legally acceptable? And then I'll move on to the more traditional ethical issues as to whether this is something we should be doing. Would it be good public policy to be using vaccines and implantable drugs under coercion of some sort? So I'll be asking if it's ethical, safe and effective, cost-effective, meaning that this is a sensible value for money way of spending public money, particularly, and issues around equity, who benefits from these sorts of treatment, who will pay for them. So first, if we look at a cocaine vaccine, and the question is worth asking, why would you want to develop a cocaine vaccine? Well, for the better part of two decades in the US, cocaine abuse was a major social, public health and public order problem. There were really two cocaine epidemics in the US in the late 70s until middle 1980s, which was primarily intranasal forms of cocaine use that was widely disseminated amongst young Americans in much the same way that cannabis had been. And with 1985 marking the advent of discovery of crack cocaine, a way of preparing powder cocaine that could made it very easy to smoke and very cheap to sell when the drug really took off in the inner-city ghettos of many US cities and fueled a lot of crime and violence and major health problems. Now, cocaine is a very nasty drug. It's a stimulant drug that makes people alert and awake and provides euphoric effects. And it's a very short-acting drug, particularly when smoked, so people want to continue to readminister the drug, often with high frequency, and engage in patterns of binge use that might go on for 24 or 48 hours. And those who get involved in that very heavy pattern of cocaine use can experience very serious health problems. We see fatalities in young adults dying of strokes because these drugs are a massive stimulant effect on the heart and cardiovascular system. So you can get young people dropping dead of strokes, heart attacks, and cardiac arrhythmias. They can also develop or acquire HIV infection from needle sharing and engaging in high-risk sex to fund drug use. And if people use these drugs in large doses for long periods of time, they can develop really nasty psychoses and become quite violent and paranoid. So they're a nasty drug for individuals, and they can have serious treatment, serious social consequences. The treatment options available to help people with cocaine problems have been fairly limited. We haven't had effective forms of drug treatment to assist people to remain abstinent from these drugs, and we do have psychosocial forms of treatment, psychotherapy of various sorts, which can be effective, modestly effective. The major difficulty with people undergoing treatment for cocaine dependence is keeping them in treatment long enough for them to benefit from it. So for those sorts of reasons, the idea that we could develop a drug that might block the effects of cocaine was seen as a very attractive way to improve the treatment of this form of drug dependence. So the American National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is the major research group in the US that funds drug research, and in fact boasts accurately enough of funding 85% of the world's research on drug abuse and addiction, has funded work on the development of cocaine vaccines for quite a while. So how would it work? Well, it is a vaccine, and it does use the immune system to raise antibodies against the cocaine molecule. And that's not an easy thing to do, because the cocaine molecule is a very small one compared to the large biological structures that most microorganisms comprise. So in order to induce the body to raise antibodies, you have to combine the cocaine molecule with some form of protein that will provoke a response from the immune system. The intention being that these antibodies will bind to the cocaine that people might use in the bloodstream and prevent it from getting to the brain and acting on the receptors in the brain that produce the euphoric effects. So that's the theory. And in fact, there's a lot of animal models showing that you can in fact do this. Rats are quite easily persuaded to self-administer cocaine by injection and will do it to the point of exhaustion if allowed. So it's quite easy to develop plausible animal models of human cocaine addiction, and it's been demonstrated that in rat models you can raise antibodies to cocaine, and when rats have been vaccinated you in fact abolish self-administration. They will no longer self-administer cocaine. So we have good animal evidence that this is a feasible approach, which is why people put money into attempting to develop it. So how would we use it if we were to develop it? Well, primarily, as I've indicated, the main motivation for its development was to treat people who were cocaine dependent, primarily designed for, in the jargon, relapse prevention. Is the big problem with most forms of drug addiction, as Mark Twain famously said about cigarette smoking, he'd quit hundreds of times. It's staying stopped is the challenge for cocaine, as it is for nicotine and a lot of other forms of drug dependence. So the intention was to vaccinate people who'd achieved abstinence so that if they did, as it were, succumb to temptation and use cocaine, they wouldn't experience the rewarding effects and therefore would be less likely to return to regular cocaine use. So primarily the motivation was for treatment. And it could be used to treat voluntary patients, as I mentioned, that is people coming forward seeking treatment because they recognise they have a problem with cocaine, or it could be potentially used for people who would be coerced into treatment in ways that I'll talk about in a moment. And as I've already said, you use the word vaccine and you raise expectations that perhaps we should vaccinate all children or adolescents against the effects of cocaine. I went to a conference in Mexico City in 2002 at which the Mexican health minister was speculating that they'd vaccinate all their migrant workers before they went to the US so that they wouldn't acquire cocaine habits and that they'd bring back to them to Mexico. So it's an idea that's very appealing. It's a sort of a quick technological fix to problems of addiction. Get this to move. There we go. So I've already indicated that studies in animals provide proof of concept that you can induce antibodies that reduce cocaine effects in rats, stop the sort of increased locomotor activity, the sort of running around that rats do when they've been given cocaine, and abolish self-administration. We've also got some human evidence, a small number of phase one human trials, meaning trials that have been done in small numbers of individuals to see if they tolerate the effects of the vaccine without serious adverse effects, whether antibodies are raised. And the answer has been that antibodies can be raised to cocaine in human subjects, that there are no serious unpleasant adverse side effects of vaccination. And these were done in people who are undergoing conventional treatment for cocaine dependence in therapeutic communities, which are residential forms of treatment that provide psychosocial support for abstinence. So they were vaccinated in this program, and almost all of them tested the vaccine. Let's see how good it is. And most of them reported that there was an attenuation of the effects of cocaine. That is, they felt like they'd gotten a dirty or a poor batch of cocaine. They still got an effect, but it wasn't the usual sort of effect that they had before. And there are a number of phase two trials underway, meaning trials designed to test the efficacy, whether this is an effective approach to treatment. So it's work that's in progress. We don't know definitively yet whether this will be an effective approach. So what are the pros and cons? Well, one of the big pros of this particular approach is that these vaccines don't act on the brain. A lot of the drugs that we use to treat addiction and mental illness more generally are drugs which act on neurotransmitters, that is brain chemicals and brain receptors. And these can often have fairly unpleasant side effects, which is one reason why people stop taking them. A vaccine would have longer lasting effects than taking a single pill once a day, which has been the traditional way that we take medication. So compliance with treatment is likely to be much better. And it's an approach that is not intended to be standalone, meaning it's the only treatment. It would be used in combination with other forms, particularly of psychosocial treatment and support, addressing underlying interpersonal and personal problems that people might have. On the con side, I mean, vaccines are not easily reversed, so if you give your agreement to being vaccinated and then you change your mind the next day, then you're going to have to live with the consequences of that for a little longer. But as we'll see, not forever, because most of these antibodies are transient. They typically provide protection for 2 to 3 months rather than the rest of your life, which is what we typically tend to think of vaccines against infectious diseases doing. And secondly, it's not foolproof. It's not 100% effective. If you're really intent on overcoming the effects of the drug, of the vaccine, you just increase the dose of the drug to get over the top of the blockade, which could be a bad thing because cocaine's a particularly toxic drug. So if you're taking much larger than usual doses to get over the antibody blockade, then you could produce serious cardiovascular effects. And I guess on the con side, it's not intended to be a standalone treatment, but there is a temptation to think we've got a vaccine, problem solved, magic bullet. It's not intended to be, and it will need to be used in combination with more traditional psychosocial forms of care. So that's a vaccine, and it's primarily being developed against cocaine. I can talk later. The other area of interest is a nicotine vaccine, which is further along in development as an aid to smoking cessation. And there's potential for developing vaccines against heroin and methamphetamine. The other approach I want to talk about is an idea that's been around for a very long time. This is naltrexone. It's a drug that you've probably heard of because there's been a fair amount of controversy about this drug over the last 15 or so years in Australia. It's an opioid antagonist, meaning that it's a drug which doesn't have any effect except to block the effects that heroin and other opioid drugs like morphine, methadone, buprenorphine have on the brain. So if you take naltrexone and you have naltrexone circulating in your bloodstream, it will lock onto the receptors, those sites in the brain where heroin acts. And if you take heroin while you've got naltrexone in your system, you won't experience any of the positive effects that you'd normally get. It was first introduced, in fact, it was one of the few positive outcomes of Richard Nixon's war on drugs, was the development of identification of opioid receptors in the brain and the identification and development of opioid antagonists like naltrexone, drugs that block the effects of heroin. So there was a lot of excitement in the 1970s that this was an effective way of treating heroin addiction. The problem with oral naltrexone is that people don't take it. Except if they're coerced into doing so, and the population where this form of treatment's been most effective are doctors who develop problems with opiate dependence, who are allowed to practice on condition that their urines are monitored for evidence of drugs, and often that they're taking a drug like naltrexone to block the effects of opiates. And generally there's been fairly low interest in naltrexone amongst heroin-dependent people, except when you have rather unscrupulous promoters who promise to cure heroin addiction in 24 hours by anaesthetising people and flushing their opiate receptors out with naltrexone, which happened here in Australia in the late 1990s. So the oral naltrexone doesn't work, so what the approach that's been adopted has been to create an implantable form of the drug, that is, you can either inject a long-acting form of the drug that's slowly released into the bloodstream over a period of a month, or in the implantable form that's been developed in Western Australia, you implant a drug which acts for up to 6 months. There's some evidence from a number of small clinical trials suggesting that this might be an appropriate or an effective form of treatment. And the drug has been approved in the US on the basis of a single Russian study suggesting that this is an effective approach to treatment. As with a vaccine, this could be potentially used to treat addiction in people who come forward for treatment voluntarily, or it could potentially be used under some form of legal coercion. So I'll talk briefly about the first set of issues, and I don't think there are any novel or sort of outstanding or insurmountable ethical issues in using either of these approaches for relapse prevention in voluntary patients. If people come forward for treatment, volunteer for treatment, if the treatments are shown to be safe and effective by clinical trials and they give free and informed consent to treatment, that is, they fully understand what it is they're agreeing to and give their consent under those circumstances, then I don't see any particular problems with the use of this form of treatment. The only issues are whether it's cost-effective, meaning that this is a good buy, so in the Australian healthcare system we'd be prepared to subsidise it on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. And that remains to be seen. That's an issue that will be addressed by clinical trials. And we'd need to be able to subsidise it, because if this was a form of treatment that people had to pay for, given that a lot of people who are cocaine or heroin dependent are not earning a living in any legitimate way, they'd find it very difficult to fund this form of treatment. We don't know what the costs are, but it might be of several thousand dollars of that sort of order. So it's not necessarily a cheap option. So we move on to the more contentious issue as to whether this form of a treatment should be used under some form of coerced or some form of coercion. And there's a variety of ways in which this could be done. I'm not going to talk about all of them in depth. The first of this is very much along the lines that Jane's talking about. And in the case of people with serious mental illnesses such as psychosis, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, we have legislation which enables people to be compelled to undergo treatment for their own good. And in fact, this was an approach that we used in the past in Australia to treat addiction as well. It was under the terminology of inebriacy. People who were inebriates could be sentenced to 6 months treatment for typically alcohol dependence in a remote country mental hospital, and magistrates could sentence them to treatment. I think New South Wales still has a statute on the books, but it's very rarely used, although it's been recently revived on a trial basis in New South Wales, and there have been proposals to do something similar in Victoria. But I want to talk more about the second one, because this is the more frequent rationale for coercing people into addiction treatment. It's where the interest is less in the good of the individual who's addicted rather than protecting the public good. And that's typically done through the criminal justice system when an addicted individual has been convicted of an offence related to their drug dependence, where they're offered treatment as an alternative to imprisonment with the aim of reducing their recidivism, meaning their return to drug use, and to protect the public. And so I want to ask the question is whether this latter form of coerced treatment is ethical, and if so, whether it's a form of treatment that might legitimately include vaccines and implants as forms of treatment. Gone too fast. Just make the point that it's probably not as well understood as it could be, that drug use, although technically still a criminal offence in most Australian states, is rarely enforced per se. That is, that people very rarely go to jail simply because they're caught using drugs. Although the fact that the law remains on the statute means that it's a law that is occasionally used by the police, often in a discriminatory way, to lock up people we think or suspect of having done something much worse that we're unable to demonstrate. In the courts, if people commit a criminal offence and they plead addiction as an excuse, the courts are usually unmoved by that sort of argument. We don't generally say, well, we're going to let you off because you committed this offence to fund your drug use, you knocked over a house or dealt drugs to fund your drug use. But the courts do see addiction as a reason for mitigating sentence, that is, reducing the severity of sentence. And the circumstance in which this is typically done is to coerce people into treatment instead of jail. And this... sorry about that. I'm too far. I'm in the right way. Yes, this is coerced treatment instead of imprisonment. It usually requires either a conviction or people to make a plea of guilty, plead guilty to the offence. And the form of treatment that's offered is usually community-based addiction treatment rather than treatment in imprisonment. Compulsory treatment, meaning that the court sentences an individual to treatment, is very, very rare in Australia. I say very rare because there is a program in New South Wales which has treated, I think, maybe 50 or 60 people over the last several years. And this is a form of maximum form of coerced treatment. There's, the most restrictive option, I guess, in the terms that Jane mentioned earlier. There's no element of choice. People are sentenced to treatment. And as I said, there is the historical precedent under the Inebriates Act, and there's a New South Wales compulsory drug treatment program. But on the whole, this approach has really not been taken too well, and largely because of disastrous experience with it. This was American policy for nearly 40 years to sentence heroin-addicted individuals to treatment in so-called public health narcotic hospitals in Lexington, Kentucky and Fort Worth, Texas. And thousands of people from big cities in the US were sent for compulsory treatment for up to 12 months, which involved detoxification, meaning withdrawing them from opiates, compulsory group therapy and no real supervision after release, with the unsurprising result that 90% of people went back to heroin use after they got out of these programs. There was a similar program in California in the 1960s, which was a bit more effective, not so much because of the compulsory treatment, but because of fairly substantial supervision when people went back into the community. So this the idea of compulsory treatment is one that's largely been abandoned. There are a couple of countries. The Netherlands, interestingly enough, has a compulsory-based prison treatment program, which was the model for the New South Wales one. And a lot of developing countries, particularly China and Vietnam, have what they describe as treatment, which is basically imprisonment in fairly brutal regimes. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime has recently issued the conclusion that what's called compulsory treatment, particularly in countries like China and Vietnam, isn't treatment under any sense, and it's no evidence of effectiveness, and it's a violation of human rights of drug users. So I think the most coercive form, most restrictive option, is one that we don't primarily use in Australia, and it's not one that's internationally well supported. There is more support for this option of what I've described as coerced treatment, which is not compulsory, but treatment as an option instead of imprisonment. And the arguments for this are fairly straightforward. As we've said, drug dependence is very common amongst offenders, particularly those who frequently offend for property and drug dealing offences. And it's causally related to their offences. That is, they commit their offences because, at least in part, of their addiction. It's very, very expensive to imprison someone, as the point is often made. It costs about the same as to stay at the Hilton here in Adelaide as it does to imprison an individual in most state prisons. It's not a cheap option. Community treatment is a much cheaper alternative. And if you send injecting drug users into jail, they don't stop injecting. They do it less frequently because drugs aren't as available in prison as they are in the community. But when they do inject, they do it in the maximally risky way and often acquire bloodborne virus infections such as hepatitis C and much more rarely in Australia, HIV. And as already indicated, the great majority of them will return to drug use and re-offend after release. So is it ethical to be coercing addicted individuals into undergoing treatment? Well, if you're a libertarian, that is, if you believe there ain't no such thing as addiction, then it doesn't make sense to be coercing people into undergoing a treatment for a non-existent disorder. But if you're a libertarian, you also believe that all drugs should be legal for use by any adult, and drug use is not an excuse for committing offences. So drug users on that view of the world should be punished. We typically are more inclined to accept the first consequence of that view rather than the second. But that's not a view that's widely shared in the community. I guess the sort of middle of the road position, which is one I'd support, is this one here that's is now 25 years old, which is a consensus view, meaning it was a view arrived at by a group of experts convened by the World Health Organization in the late 1980s, who came to the conclusion that coerced addiction treatment was ethically acceptable if it was treatment offered for people who'd been convicted of an offence related to their drug dependence, if there was judicial oversight, that is, it wasn't something that a police officer could arrange without independent authority, and if offenders were given what they described as constrained choices, meaning you didn't have to accept treatment. If you preferred to take your chances in the prison system, then that was an option that was open to you. So you could choose treatment or imprisonment, and if you chose the treatment option, you got some choice as to what form of treatment you accepted. You weren't compelled to undergo a form of treatment, and the final requirement was that, in fact, humane and effective treatment's provided. And that's been a major problem with a lot of coerced treatment. We send people off under coercion and they don't really get the treatment. So they're the sort of conditions that I think under which this might be ethically acceptable. So given that sort of approach, would it be acceptable to use vaccines and implants under some form of legal coercion? Well, I'd certainly argue, assuming that they're proven to be effective and safe, I'd say that it is acceptable to offer them as one choice amongst a range of options that people might be offered. But in order to do that, we need to know that they are in fact safe and effective, and we need to know how easily subverted they are. That is, how easy is it for people to find a way around it? There's not much point implanting a device that blocks the effects of heroin if people go off and use amphetamine or some other drug that's not blocked in that particular way. Or they find ways around it. They dig out the implant, for example, or find a friendly nurse or doctor who will remove it for them. And if they do make attempts to subvert or circumvent the effectiveness, how risky is that? Those are all empirical questions that could be addressed by undertaking research. So I think the answer to the question at the front end is it legally acceptable? I think there are conditions under which it would be legally acceptable. It remains to be seen whether these treatments are as safe and effective as they promise to be, and whether we can in fact provide them under those forms of condition. So I'll say something very briefly about preventive cocaine vaccination. It's the idea that we might vaccinate our kids. And I gather this was a view that was discussed by the Blair cabinet when Tony Blair was still the leader of the Labor Party, because it was an idea that was floated in the British press at the time, that you'd have a heel prick at birth which would diagnose your addiction susceptibility, and if you're at increased risk of addiction, you'd be vaccinated against all the major drugs of dependence. Problem solved. Very, very attractive to politicians. The problem with it, as with often quick technological fixes of this sort, is it's based on false assumptions. As I've already indicated, vaccines don't provide 100% immunity against the effects of drug for life. It provides limited protection. It attenuates the effects of drugs for some several months after vaccination, and so is potentially useful in treating people who are already drug dependent. It's unlikely to be useful. It would require frequent, repeated revaccination to provide protection throughout adolescence. And there are all sorts of ethical issues raised by the idea that minors might be vaccinated with or without parental consent, not to mention the cost of doing this. And this is an approach you'd only think about doing if these sorts of approaches prove to be effective approaches to treating addiction, and we're a long way from that. So some provisional conclusions to then wrap up and allow plenty of discussion and questions. Drug vaccines are an interesting approach. They're still at the phase of being developed. They're a very novel therapeutic approach and using immunology to prevent relapse to drugs of addiction. The big uncertainty, which I haven't talked about, is whether anybody's going to be prepared to put up the money to get these drugs developed and bring them to market. And that, I think that is a real limitation of this particular approach. Pharmaceutical industry runs a million miles from drug addiction. There's not a lot of interest in developing drugs for this. And my favourite story about the pharmaceutical industry is when I first got into the addiction field nearly 20-odd years ago, we held a conference on the treatment of heroin dependence, and we approached the drug companies that supply the drugs, methadone primarily at that time, used to treat heroin addiction, for some funding to bring out some speakers, and they were prepared to give us a small amount of money on condition that we didn't mention their name. This is not usually the way drug companies like to behave when they're giving money to fund conferences. So that's the big unknown, and it's not surprising that most of the funding that's gone into the development of these vaccines has been from the US government. So that's the big unknown, whether the money will be put up to bring these drugs, well, to put them through the fairly extensive regulatory process that will show whether they're safe and effective and likely to be cost-effective. If they do look to be more promising, then we will need more public debate about their possible use, particularly under legal coercion and their use with minors for the prevention of drug addiction. I'd hazard some predictions. These are ones that may or may not prove to be true in the longer haul. And the first of these is that vaccines are not a magic bullet, and neither are drug implants, but they needn't be perfect to be useful. And I think that's the thing we need to remind ourselves of with all drug approaches. They, small advances in relapse prevention would be very useful in this area where we don't have a lot to offer, particularly for drugs like cocaine. If they do prove to be safe and effective, the next sort of challenge will be demonstrating that they're a good enough buy for the public to be prepared to subsidise them, because we will need public subsidy to make these forms of treatment available for addicted individuals. And we will need to have some serious discussions about the major ethical and policy concerns raised, particularly about the more controversial uses of them, because the concern is that if we do get hung up on their use under coercion or their use for preventive purposes, we could lose a potentially useful intervention for the treatment of drug dependence. And I'll finish there so there's plenty of time for questions and discussion. So thanks for your attention.
Thanks very much, Wayne. And that's right, we do have some time now for audience members to ask questions. And what I would do is ask that you ask your question from the microphone, which is at the back of this room, and because the Radio Adelaide is recording this session, and so to allow the questions to be heard, if you could make your way to the back of the room. But Wayne, to start off the discussion, there's a couple of questions I'm interested in. Now, you touched on this in your talk today, that one of the considerations with the cocaine vaccine and the success of this vaccination, if it does get to that stage, is how effective is it if ultimately a person who has been addicted to cocaine, is successfully vaccinated, but uses another drug, such as heroin, or, as we know, more and more drugs that come onto the market. Is it really, how do we address that problem? Do we consider more than one vaccination for a person, or is this really just not really addressing the causes of addiction? Is this it's a worthwhile thing to do?
Yeah, I think that speaks to the point I made earlier, that it's not a magic bullet. It's not going to be a single solution to the problems of addiction, and no form of drug treatment or no form of psychosocial intervention will be either. mean, typically people develop problems with addiction because their lives aren't going well for a whole variety of reasons. They might have an undiagnosed mental illness, that is, they might be depressed, for example, and using drugs to, as it were, self-medicate their depressed affect and with the undesirable secondary consequence of developing drug dependence as an effect. Or they may not have much in the way of education, they don't have lots of career options or choices, or they might have a parental or family history of substance abuse and they've had a fairly chaotic upbringing. So often people with problems of addiction need to have more than the problem they have with the drug addressed, and we do have to address the problem, and if people are unable to stop taking the drug, then you can't begin to address a lot of the other underlying problems as well. So there are, in the case of opiate dependence, for example, a frequent criticism of the dominant approach in this country to treat heroin dependence is to use drugs like methadone and buprenorphine as an oral substitute, and people say, well, that's not addressing the underlying addiction problem, which is true. I mean, you're substituting one much less harmful form of opiate dependence for another. But in a lot of cases, if people are still using street heroin, then it's much harder for them to start to address underlying issues, to undergo rehabilitation, personal rehabilitation, to acquire skills that enable them to become employed, to address issues that might arise from if they've got children, for example, who are... So it is a large and complicated issue, and I'd agree that these forms of drug treatment have to be seen as providing some form of assistance to address the larger issues that you know, are still there.
Thanks, Wayne. Just before I ask that the gentleman at the back to ask his question, and it flows on from, I think, your response to my question. And psychosocial care, I know in the work that I do, is a large component of treatment. Mm. But I guess in terms of coerced treatment, if someone is opting to have treatment as an alternative to imprisonment, and psychosocial treatment and care is part of that, but if a person is reluctant or unwilling to undergo that form of treatment, does this pose a problem?
It certainly does. I mean, that's one of the dilemmas of conscripting people into undergoing treatment, particularly forms of treatment that presuppose they're engaged. If they're not engaging, then everyone's wasting their time. And I guess that's an issue I haven't talked about, which is a tricky one around coerced treatment, is the way in which the criminal justice system and the therapeutic approaches intersect. Because the courts typically want to know if people aren't complying, reasonably enough, because if it's seen as a condition of release into the community that you're involved in treatment and you're not cooperating, then the reasonable option is for you to suffer the consequence, which is usually to undergo imprisonment. And often treatment services are a bit reluctant to, as it were, being seen to inform on patients. So addressing that particular issue can be very, very tricky in coerced treatment. And there is a real risk that you can overwhelm voluntary treatment services with large numbers of reluctant, resentful, conscripted patients, which is bad for treatment programs, bad for the morale of staff, and generally fairly bad. So there are major issues around how you work out that often don't get the sort of attention that they deserve.
Can I ask you to expand a bit on a couple of related issues that you just touched on, which mm-hmm. is alcohol addiction and yeah. the issue of coerced treatment for a person's own good? Mm-hmm. Just recently, I was called to give evidence at a coroner's hearing for the deaths of four Aboriginal people who all died over a period of 2 or 3 years in a country town. They were people who'd come from a remote Aboriginal community where alcohol wasn't available and were living rough in that town. Mm-hmm. The causes of death varied, but the common factor was that they were all drinking heavily and the alcohol use and the lifestyle associated, that was a significant contributor to their death. My argument to the coroner, the case I was making, was that the health system was failing in this part of South Australia because treatments weren't being made available for people with alcohol addiction. Mm-hmm. The coroner asked me whether for people who were as at risk, as these people clearly were before they died, and if they're not willing to have treatment and treatment was available, whether there should be an element of coercion in that treatment. And I must admit that question threw me a bit, and I fudged the answer and said I'm not prepared to give it a definitive answer. I just wonder what your answer would have been.
Well, I think you raise an important question, because most of the attention to coerced treatment has been around other forms of drug addiction. I think it's worth asking why alcohol's been excluded. I think it's partly for historical reasons, and largely because of the manifest failure of the Old Inebriates Act. It's now 40 years ago, when I was an undergraduate medical student, I worked in the then Callan Park Mental Hospital, which served the catchment area for inner city Sydney. And we, the police used to bring to us all the seriously psychotic people off the streets. And about 25% was one of the first pieces of research I ever did on night duty, was to go through the list of patients and work out why they were there. And 25% of patients were in there under the Old Inebriates Act. And typically what treatment consisted of, these were drunks who were picked up off the street by the police, and if they were lucky, they went to a magistrate who said 6 months at Bloomfield, which was out at Orange. And they'd be sent to this nice country mental hospital where they'd be dried out, fed up, given good food, lodging. They'd do their 6 months, they'd accumulate a nice pension for a little bender or spree when they got out, and they'd go straight back to drinking. And the hospitals that were providing this treatment got sick of it, and psychiatrists generally became very pessimistic about the value of this form of treatment, because there wasn't any treatment offered. It was just basically a sort of a drying out in a reasonably pleasant surroundings where you were locked up. So I think there's been a reluctance. There is a renewed interest in extending some of these coerced forms of treatment to people who are alcohol dependent. And I think there's a good case to be made for doing that. That is under the model that I've been talking about. So people who are recurrently drunk in public places or who might engage in offences of violence might be offered treatment under that form of compulsion. As I said earlier, New South Wales has been experimenting with compulsory treatment modelled on the Mental Health Act for people with serious forms of alcohol and drug problem whose lives are at serious risk for the sorts of reasons you've just indicated in those sorts of cases. There's a lot of resistance to that idea from people who've been tasked with treating these individuals, because you basically have to imprison them, they don't want to be there. I was asked to give evidence to a parliamentary inquiry that set up the trial, and my view was that the problem with most of these programs is that we don't really offer much in the way of treatment. There may well be a case for short periods of coerced treatment, as we do with people who are acutely psychotic, to see if we can stabilise individuals, then put effort into hooking them into treatment to see if we can get them away from returning to the street. And I think we probably need to do better than we do with alcohol, and I think there probably is a place for coerced forms of treatment for alcohol dependence, which is a much bigger problem in lots of ways, particularly with the criminal justice system, that is, there's drug dependence.
I had heard some years ago of this sort of concept of, say, a vaccine against drugs, and knowing almost nothing about it, I thought, I'm against it. And the reason is, say, cocaine. Mm-hmm. I have not taken cocaine, but I've been the beneficiary of local anaesthetics that are very similar, and I certainly wouldn't like to be immunised against it so that those local anaesthetics wouldn't work on me. And, you know, for minor surgery, say it's having to have a general. And going on from there, you know, I haven't taken heroin, but I've certainly taken a bit of endone. Wonderful stuff. And my parents, in their terminal stage, both dying of malignancies, were the beneficiaries of opioids, mostly fentanyl. Certainly would not want anyone to be unable to access those drugs in the terminal stages with intractable pain, you know. And so the idea of... I had assumed that a vaccination would be permanent. I'm so relieved that you say that if someone ever does try to vaccinate a child against an adolescent, it won't be permanent. And I would love to see if something could be done that was reversible, really readily reversible, if they had an implant and then suddenly needed, you know, a local anaesthetic or something like that. The implant could be taken out, they could be dried out, and then, you know, the surgery or whatever be done. Something very quickly reversible would be good, but nothing permanent. Everyone understand what I'm saying?
I mean, they're good reasons, concern. Let me reassure you that these vaccines are highly specific, so a drug against heroin, a vaccine against heroin, would not block all opiates.
Oh, right.
So, and the same with cocaine. That's the intention, that you've really got a high specificity, so it's a vaccine that blocks that drug. Yes. I mean, this issue of difficulty treating people with opiates arises now with people who are opiate dependent. If you're already a heroin or methadone patient, it's a bit of a challenge to get an adequate opiate dose because you've got your receptors almost fully occupied. So there are problems. There are ways of dealing that. I mean, it's not an area that I'm an expert in, but it is a problem that people are acquainted with. So I can reassure you on both points that the drugs they're not lifelong, and they're highly specific, the vaccines. And the implant would be the way of addressing your concern. If people did change their mind, then the device can be removed or its effects attenuate in other ways.
To follow on from the last question, and moving in the opposite direction, you said that the cocaine vaccine has a limited effectiveness. I was wondering, has thought been given to giving a series of injections, rather like triple vaccine for small infants, to produce an anamnestic and augmented and therefore longer-lasting response to the cocaine vaccine?
Well, the vaccines that are typically used are given in multiple doses now. They're typically, I didn't go into details, but they'd be given sort of once a week for up to a month. That's the sort of schedule you need to provide protection for 2 to 3 months. So that's been one of the limitations of that. Whether you could extend the period of protection is a bit uncertain. I mean, the trade-off obviously is if you want to boost the level of immunity, you increase the risk of adverse side effects and might reduce people's interest in being vaccinated.
Sorry, can I just ask two questions? One, this coerced treatment, perhaps, of the alcohol, does that mean we're going to see a revisit of, you know, the old antabuse, which is that drug that you take that makes you sick if you drink? Is that being used in treatment now? And the other thing I'd like to know more about is the nicotine vaccine.
The antabuse, in fact, there was an editorial in the Medical Journal of Australia only a week ago from, I think, three leading addiction specialists in Australia asking for a return of antabuse as an option. It's not covered by the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, And because it's not covered, the company don't bother to market it here. There's not much interest in it. There are implantable forms of that drug. This is a drug which differs from naltrexone. Naltrexone largely just blocks the effect, so you don't get a buzz from taking heroin or alcohol. It turns out naltrexone is also effective in the treatment of alcohol dependence because it blunts the rewarding effects of alcohol. Antabuse is a drug that produces nausea, vomiting, and pretty nasty symptoms if people drink alcohol. There are substantial numbers of people of Asian ancestry who carry a gene that's sort of like a built-in antabuse that makes people flush and get ill when they drink alcohol. Well, this drug reproduces that sort of genetic effect. So it could potentially have a role in treating alcohol dependence if it were to be made available. Nicotine vaccine is an approach that's been more extensively investigated. There's been three companies that have trialled nicotine vaccines, and so far the results have been disappointing. The animal studies show strong efficacy. You can vaccinate rats against nicotine. You can prevent rats from self-administering nicotine in the way that they do cocaine. But it hasn't been possible to raise antibodies sufficiently high enough in smokers to produce effects that are superior to placebo. You get about a third of people developing enough antibodies, and in that third who do, rates of relapse to smoking are substantially reduced, but in two-thirds of people you don't get enough effect.
Obviously, drug vaccination is not addressing any of the behavioural side of addiction. So if it was going to be proposed as a treatment in coerced treatment protocols, is there any way that you could guarantee that there would be a psychosocial element of that treatment as well as the vaccination? Because obviously if the vaccination's effects are weakening over time, and you'd think that long use of the vaccination would eventually cause the person to habituate to that vaccination. Wouldn't it be better to address the psychosocial aspects?
Oh, I think if vaccines were to be used as a form of coercion, it would be offered by conventional treatment programs, so those forms of support would be provided. Yeah.
So not in isolation?
No, it's not primarily intended as a standalone treatment, and it wouldn't work if it was provided that way. I mean, there's always a risk that it might be, because that's the cheaper approach, and governments don't like to spend money and taxpayers don't like to pay taxes, so I guess that's the standard risk we run more generally. But certainly the intention would be to provide it in that sort of context.
Hi, I'm wondering what you see as a future for nicotine addiction, perhaps looking towards the horizon where nothing's been invented yet. And yeah. I'm interested in a notion that came to me the other day in a discussion that was regarding jacking up the price of smokes even more, making the packets ugly and so on. Yeah. We've dropped tobacco addiction from 50% down to 20%. Now we've just got to do the rest. But some people in the field said, yes, but that last 20% may be the toughest nut to crack. They may be the people that all the other coercions, price, scaring, whatever, doesn't work on. We may need a new approach for them. So, being afflicted myself and smoking a fairly strong brand, what are your thoughts? Thank you.
Yeah, they're very important questions, and they're ones, in fact, I've written a fair amount on. And I think it is an important question because, as you say, we've succeeded in getting the prevalence of smoking down. I think in the household survey that's just been released, it's now 15% of Australian adults who are daily smokers. And for people who continue to smoke under the circumstances of what you might think of as maximal discouragement, you know, where it's a very, very expensive thing to do, the opportunities to smoke are progressively restricted, there's basically social ostracism of smokers, and there are people who persist in smoking under those sorts of circumstances. So how coercive should we be permitted to be in attempting to get smoking prevalence down? We're under 10%, which I think is the target now for the National Preventative Task Force. I guess for many people in the public health field, they'd want to get cigarettes out of convenience stores, supermarkets, make it much more difficult to purchase cigarettes. There are, I guess, a minority view, and I'm amongst it, that what we should be doing is offering non-smoke forms of tobacco as alternatives, that it is ironical that in Australia and most of Europe that the most hazardous form of tobacco is freely available at any corner store, and much less hazardous forms, and by much less hazardous I mean 80-90% less hazardous forms of tobacco, non-smoke forms of tobacco, typically not chewing tobacco but oral snus, the Swedish product, where a tobacco preparation is put in the mouth between the lip and the gum, and the nicotine is absorbed through the oral mucosa. In Sweden, half of Swedish men who smoked have switched to that form of tobacco, and we now have about 20 years of good health research indicating that you eliminate the respiratory risks, you very, very substantially reduce the cardiovascular risks of smoking, and you probably end up with a product which is less harmful than alcohol, which is not a harmless substance, but if we're using that as a benchmark, we could very, very substantially reduce the harms of those people who continue to smoke. And I've suggested with colleagues that we should combine those two approaches, making it progressively more difficult to smoke or use smoked tobacco products, and easier and cheaper to use alternative forms for those people who want to use nicotine as an alternative.
Thanks, Wayne. Well, I think you've opened up a whole another area of discussion. It might be appropriate for another Festival Ideas session. But I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Wayne for his session today, and also importantly to thank everyone for coming along today and providing such good questions and for being a great audience. So thanks very much. Thanks, Wayne.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.